Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Right, well, welcome to the Lords Cricket Podcast. This week, the show is with Angus Fraser. Gus played 46 test matches for England, taking 177 test wickets at an average of 27.32. He took 13 five-wicket hauls in his test career, two of which came here at Lords. One in 1990 versus India, where he took 5 for 104. We don't really touch on that in the podcast because that is the game where Graham Gooch scored 333 in the first innings and 123 in the second. So it's kind of best remembered for that. What we do talk about in terms of his Lords playing days is obviously his time at Middlesex, but also in 1995, the second time when Gus got on the honours board. That was against the West Indies. It was 5 for 66 he took. It was a fantastic test match. Gus took his 100th wicket in it, which was Brian Lara. So he has some lovely memories about that. So without much further ado, this is the Lords Cricket Podcast with Angus Fraser.
Remember, it was a very, very hot, humid day. It was a big storm in the afternoon. Wore my England sweater all day, sweating because I didn't want to take it off.
Why was that?
Just got so proud to wear it.
Really?
Yeah, so just wanted to wear it.
You're listening to the Lords Cricket Podcast with me, Will Rowe. These are the stories from the home of cricket with the people that made them. Well, welcome to this edition of the Lords Cricket Podcast. And it's my absolute pleasure to be joined by a man that really is Mr. Lords in many ways. Angus Fraser, how are you doing?
I'm very well, yourself?
Yes, very good, thank you.
Mr. Lords, blimey.
In the research, you know, you played for Middlesex, you're a one-county man, one club, you captained Middlesex towards the end of your career, you've been on the MCC committee, obviously you played for England here. You know this ground maybe better than anyone.
I think, yeah, well, I say working here is a privilege, isn't it? I mean, sat here now in the, what's this room? It's the members' lounge.
Members' lounge.
Top of the pavilion, looking over the grey roofs and at the sky. To think, spent the thick end of 35 years, mostly 35 years working life working here. Sit home sometimes, or sit in my office sometimes, feeling sorry for myself, but I've been quite lucky, haven't I?
I'm going to open with a question. Did you enjoy bowling? Because looking back at some of the tapes, I think the iconic image of you is kicking the dust in frustration.
Or looking absolutely shattered before you let go of the ball. Running, sweating, red-faced. Yes, I did. I loved it. I loved the competing. There's nothing better. I mean, I suppose it's how many times you think it, but when I ran up to bowl, I sort of had a mental image of what that ball was going to look like or what the end result was. And it was always sort of hitting the seam, just bouncing a bit, nipping away, taking the edge and being caught at second slip. And sort of doing things like that or that outcome are coming along every now and then, and other outcomes where you've actually done something well and walking off the field having had with a sense of achievement, and it doesn't always reflect itself with a 5 for 40 or something like that. It might be 2 for 80 off 37 overs on a flat pitch and in the context of everything. So yeah, getting that competitive spirit or getting that element out of you and also finding something that gives you as much satisfaction is difficult, I think, for a lot of players when they leave cricket. And I've managed to do that, and to some extent, because you've had to be absorbed with other jobs that you've done and commit to them. But no, I love bowling, and I wish I was fit and 26 again rather than 53 and carrying a bit too much timber.
Let's go back to your early life. You were born in 1965 to Irene and Don Fraser. You're actually born in Lancashire.
Yeah, I'm farming stock.
Yeah.
The surname is Scottish, so my grandfather was Scottish. And he was in the police force, and he met a Lancashire woman. So my dad was born, so they moved down to Greater Manchester, where my dad was born. And my mum's side of the family is farming stock from the side of the East Lancashire Road.
Right.
Astley Tilsley Lee, and Billinge was a maternity hospital. It doesn't no longer exist, actually. I think, was it Richard Ashcroft from The Verve? He was born there.
Oh, right.
So something like that. Sort of one of those silly little things that people sort of say.
Yeah.
And we moved south when I was two, so no real recollections with my dad's work, and ended up in Harrow Weald, sort of just outside in the outskirts of London. And my father passed away sort of 6 or 7 years ago, and my mother's still in the same house that we moved into. So always lived in Harrow. When I was moved in with my girlfriend Denise, now my wife, we moved to Hatch End and then to Pinner. So we've always lived within sort of 2 or 3 miles of family home, really, in Harrow Weald.
What was life like growing up in Harrow? Was it sort of normal childhood? Well, how would you describe it?
Well, my dad worked abroad quite a lot,
yeah,
because he was a structural engineer, and quite a few of the contracts they had were sort of building hospitals in Bahrain and Karachi and Pakistan and places like that. So he was quite away quite a lot. So my mum did a lot of ferrying around. So sport rotten. I mean, it's one of those things where you look back at, and I'd imagine a lot of sportsmen could do it. And I suppose the starting point is the Matthew Syed, about all those table tennis players living in one street, and the fact that they were all there pushing each other, playing against each other. They all got better and you look at your childhood and the fact that I had a brother rather than a sister, so that I had someone to play with. But there were 3 or 4 other families with boys in the street. So you used to play in the street then. In those days, there wasn't sort of cars, ram pack. There were grass verges, and you could play cricket in the street.
It's a sporting childhood for Angus Fraser. Not just a talented cricketer, he plays golf, football and rugby too. The young Angus could in fact kick penalties from the halfway line for Harrow Rugby Club. He plays his cricket for Stanmore, a club in northwest London near his home, and still has connections there to this day. As a late developer, he spends his youth very much in the shadow of his younger brother, Alistair.
I spent most of my childhood very jealous of my brother, really, because he was, in many people's eyes, the Fraser that was going to make it. So we'd obviously, like families get a name, sort of,
yeah,
a couple of good sportsmen in them. And Alistair, my brother, was always going to be the one that was going to make it. And he was playing for Middlesex at sort of under 13s when he was 11, and always, I mean, he's a fantastic athlete and still is. And sort of bowled fast, threw the ball miles, and could whack the ball about, and he was playing for England, huge young England sides, and I just remember constantly dropping off at hotel and on this latest tour extravaganza that he was going on, and I was sort of chucked back in the back of the car driving home, sort of with my parents feeling totally sort of jealous of what he was going through. And I only really came through when I was, so I'd taken my O-levels when I was 16, and it was only when I went to Orange Hill from Gayton to do a year of retakes of my O-levels and then my A-levels that I got selected for Middlesex schools. And it all sort of happened very quickly after that. You suddenly sort of started doing things for Middlesex schools, got into Middlesex under 19, sadly had a stress fracture, or Middlesex young cricketers as they were, which meant I missed that summer, then came back the next summer and got involved. And you'd made your first class debut by the time you were 18. And I think I made I got my name really through playing in club cricket. So again, playing in Colts cricket, playing for Stanmore Thirds, getting selected for the second 11. And I always remember it was August. We'd just been on a family holiday. It was the end of August 1 year, and we played my first team debut for Stanmore at Tring when I was 16, and then played my first league game a couple of weeks later when I was 16, and suddenly started performing as a 17-year-old in adult cricket, and your name got around, and all of a sudden Don Bennett, who was the Middlesex coach then, used to, not that you'd ever see him because he was always hiding in the trees or looking around corners trying to catch you by surprise, I think, or to see how you went about your cricket without people watching you. And then you go in the bar at the end of the evening and say, oh, Don Bennett was there, wasn't he? Sort of been there watching you. So your name got around and suddenly started playing for England. Middlesex, a couple of Middlesex second 11 games in 83 and got a fifer in a, was it a Bain Clarkson 55 over game as they were there at Lensbury, Teddington, against Surrey. And 1980 sort of signed on a summer contract and left school after my A-levels, really.
And it was 84 that you made your debut for Middlesex. Mm. It was down in Swansea against Cardiff. Match figures of 1 for 124, but you know that was the big, that was. I mean, it was tough going. You must have felt going into that game, this isn't going to be so simple.
I suppose in those days it was. Sorry, I'm pouring myself a cup of tea.
That's all right. You go ahead.
Yeah. there wasn't the sense amongst young people on the staff that it had to happen instantly now, which is, I mean, obviously my position at Middlesex now and trying to keep young cricketers happy is difficult because everybody wants it yesterday. Mm-hmm. And in those days, there was a reality that you're going to have to put a couple of years of work in here to sort of start pushing to get in the Middlesex side, especially when the side that they had then was an outstanding side with sort of Slack and Barlow out in the batting, Gatt at three, Bradley four, Butcher five, Downton, Embry, Edmonds, Cowans, Daniel Williams. I mean, this is one of the best sides that Middlesex ever produced, so the only opportunities you were likely to get were because of injury or England call-ups. And it was because of that you sort of, a combination of those, that you sort of got in quite quickly. So, but you didn't go there thinking, blimey, if I don't get it right this game, I'm not going to get an opportunity. There was a longer term view that was taken. I think I got a wicket in my third or fourth over, bowled Jeff Hopkins, knocked his middle stump out of the ground. It was a good ball and nipped back on him. But this is a piece of cake. And as you said, ended up with 1 for 120 odd, which a bit of a reality check, really. And there wasn't just the wickets. I just remember Winston Davis bowling. He was playing for Glamorgan that game, and standing up or sitting up there on the balcony with my pads on and my thigh guard on, thinking, how on earth am I going to cope with this fella if I get out there? But fortunately I didn't have to bat, and it sort of, the match tapered out into a draw. I remember there were a couple of things. I was sharing a room with Richard Ellis who was thirsty, and I remember sort of being in bed at an early hour and being woken up by him and an umpire one evening coming in and making a hole in a bottle of scotch, speaking in the bedroom while I'm trying to get to sleep on my debut. But yeah, times were a lot different then.
From the mid-1970s to the early 1990s, Middlesex enjoyed their most successful period as a club. Mike Brearley's set the ball rolling as captain, and when Angus comes into the side, Mike Gatting's picked up where Brearley left off. In 1985, Middlesex win the county championship, their fifth title in 9 years. I ask Angus if he was in awe of the dressing room that he walks into.
Not really, because it was interesting, because I think I'd been overlooked by Middlesex a little bit in my youth. You get a bit, not sour, but if Surrey came along, I'd have gone and played for Surrey type of thing. I just want to play cricket, and if Middlesex aren't good. So there was a bit of that attitude, but Surrey were a pretty ordinary side then. But I know Jeff Arnold, who I still know, and probably the best bowling coach that I've worked with, fantastic bowling coach when I was playing, and he'd got me down to a couple of Surrey nets, and I think in those days, well, it's strange actually, because when I first signed for Middlesex had to write to Lancashire because I was born in Lancashire to ask for permission to sign me.
Is that right?
And that was the way that it worked. I mean, nowadays there's greater freedom and people aren't tired. But I think sort of once, for Surrey to have pilfered me as such would have had to be with Middlesex's blessing, I think, in those days, whereas now obviously the freedom of movement of people to work or whatever is far, far greater. So there's not those sort of rules and regulations in place. But yeah, I just chuffed to sign. Middlesex were a huge side. In the middle of the most successful period in the club's history. I mean, it was a really professional setup. Good cricketers knew their work. They were serious about their cricket, which was, they were there to win games of cricket. And they did that, but obviously over sort of the next 4 or 5 years, from the mid 80s to the late 80s, Wayne Daniel retired, Norm Cowan was still a fine bowler, Clive Radley sort of went, Graham Barlow went, Wolf Slack sadly passed away. So there was a natural evolvement of the side, and the side that again won the championship in 1990 and 93, which I played in, that was very much a group coming together. So it had sort of Mike Roseby, who's one of my great mates, Keith Brown, John Carr, Mark Ramprakash, Philip Tufnell, Richard Johnson was starting to come through then, and again still with Cowans, Williams, Gatting, Embry, those sort of characters. So, and Desmond Haynes as an overseas player who was absolutely magnificent. So, but we were then very much close. There were lots of barbecues, the wives were all sort of at the same age, so getting involved in relationships, having children, it sort of really did come together. But it was completely different from what the team of the mid 80s that I joined.
What was Gatting like as a captain?
It was hard to believe, actually, now that he was inexperienced. So back in 1984, he just took, I think, Brearley stood down in 82, didn't he? So it was only
82, 83, yeah.
So it was only his second year in charge. But you never sensed that. You always sensed that he was in charge. I mean, Gat is a unique character. I mean, nothing is sort of unachievable. I mean, I'm surprised the Conservatives have not got involved in Brexit, because they'd just get him in a room, bang a few heads together, and sort it out. And I mean, that's Gat's mentality. And it was very much an open dressing room. And I think maybe we went through a period of trying to maintain the same environment, but cultures had changed and attitudes and behaviours had changed, and it was quite an honest open dressing where people were picked up, and if you hadn't performed there were arguments that were quite to the point. And
ever get physical?
No. I mean, you can imagine Phil Edmonds was always pretty provocative in the way he went about things, and John Embry was never someone to sort of stand back and not say. So I mean, Gat and Embers used to argue a lot. But it was there in front of everyone. It wasn't behind everybody's backs. And it was out. Yeah. You went home at the end of the day's play. You turned up. It's forgotten. And you get back to work and you do it. So it wasn't as... People weren't upset. People didn't sort of carry grudges or anything like that. But it was quite a hard dressing room to be brought up in.
Was it a fun time to be a cricketer, that kind of late 80s, early 90s? I remember you telling me, well, there's a group of us, a story, and I think we were in Abu Dhabi, about Gatting in a swimming pool incident where you were all doing some kind of workout, and then, well, I mean, you tell the story, but was it a fun? It sounded like a fun time to be playing professional sports, playing cricket.
Well, that was Gat in his brief sort of dalliance with coaching, and we were sort of pre-season tour in South Africa, and Gat, we went to a doing a training session in a swimming pool, so we're swimming widths of the pool.
Yeah.
And you'd swim a width, and then you do sort of like press ups or back, you know, tricep or bicep sort of on the side of the pool, and we're doing that, boom, 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 boom. And then all of a sudden we've heard this scream, and this body sort of like leapt out like a... Well, to say it was a salmon, I think he's doing Gat a bit of a compliment there. But there may be other animals that sort of slipped out and bang on the side, and all of a sudden, what's the noise? What's this commotion? And it was Gat, and all of a sudden, what's up, Gat? What, my feet, and the sort of blood pumping out of his toes. And he'd been doing these sort of pressed, sort of up curls type of things, up and down, facing the side of the wall, and both his toenails had got caught in the gaps between the tiles, and he'd ripped them off. And he was in agony, and sort of him there getting treated with his blood pumping out of his toes. So it wasn't a pretty sight. So anyway, he had his feet wrapped up, and he's walking around in his jandal with it was cut and bandaged. And that night, the day he did it, that night was a team dinner. So we weren't sort of had a quieter day the next day, and he was supposed to be taking it easy, but he was seen at some phone nightclub, sort of... with a few of the players that evening, which is probably not the best things to do when you've got these sort of open wounds, this sort of wet, damp foam nightclub, as they used to be then in Johannesburg. And next morning, I got a phone call, Gat saying, oh, I can't do training today, my toes have sore, you take it, Gus, because I was captain then. Well, thanks a lot, mate.
In 1988, Angus takes 88 first-class wickets that season. He says now that he felt ready at the time to play for England, but that doesn't happen till the next year, against Australia in that fateful home series of 1989. Gus makes his debut in the third test at Edgbaston, with England already two down, but he almost made his debut the match before, here at Lord's.
I always remember there were like two plastic bags of kit that were in the corner, and Mickey Stewart, who was the England coach, said that's your kit, Gus, could just check it fits. So you try your shirt on, you try your jumpers on, you try your cap on, and it's sort of, but you can't wear it until you pick for England. So then I had to basically go and train in my Middlesex kit.
Right.
So there was I training my Middlesex Siemens next door, because their sponsors were there, because I still see pictures of it every now and then. And you sort of keep looking at that kit thinking, am I going to get the chance to wear it? Am I going to get the chance to wear it? And then I was told that I wasn't playing in the Lord's Test match, so you had to hand your kit back. You think, oh my God, am I ever going to get my hands on it properly, type of thing. So that was handing my kit back to Mickey Stewart, having been left out of this Test match here. England lost the Test match here, and then I sort of got selected again for the third Test match at Edgbaston and played in it. I can't remember who. I might have played ahead of, it was either Neil Foster or Paul Jarvis, I can't remember, one of the two was. So I went into that, and it was, again, you look back at the era then. So the year before a Test match, and I always remember this, there was a dinner, and your jacket and tie. So the England team were there with the selectors and a few other people from the ECB, and there was wine on the table, and David Gower didn't like the wine. He was captain, so we ordered a bottle of nice wine, and sort of said, the waiter came around, would you like I'll have a glass of wine. So I had a glass of wine, and then they found out that it was like 20 quid a glass. It was like a probably 200 quid bottle of wine that Gow had ordered, and I said, buddy, 20 quid, 20 or 30 quid for this. And then he said, oh, we're going to have a whip round, because the ECB had said, because he'd taken the mickey, the ECB sort of said, you can't order that wine, you've got to pay for it yourself, type of thing. And I've got a, and Gower said, well, it's 30, anybody who's had a glass, it's 30 quid. 30 quid was quite a bit of money then. You're only getting sort of 1,700 quid for a Test match, type of thing. And Mickey Stewart took me on and said, Gus, I'll pay for that, don't worry, Gower's been an idiot, I'll sort it out. So, but that was the night before the Test, so there was a few glasses of wine consumed by, not that people weren't drunk or anything like that, but it was just, it was played in that sort of environment. And played the first day, felt ready to play. My first over was a maiden to Mark Taylor. Remember, it was a very, very hot, humid day. It was a big storm in the afternoon. Wore my England sweater all day, sweating because I didn't want to take it off.
Why was that? Just
got so proud to wear it.
Really?
Yeah, so just wanted to wear it. And yeah, it was a bit different. You sort of imagined, I mean, David was a very relaxed captain, to say the least, and you don't expect sort of Churchillian speeches in Land of Hope and Glory, but you expected a bit more. Sort of, you playing for your country for the first time, and it was, the bell went and Gail was, come on lads, that's the worker, we know what we've got to do and off we go, type of thing. There wasn't any sort of big speech as to what it's like to represent your country and things like that. And I don't think there was a big ceremony either about me being presented my cap. Nowadays, they always get someone to come in and present a player with his first cap, but it was very sort of just matter of fact. And it was a pretty miserable summer. Well, it was a dreadful summer for English cricket, to be honest, because, well, we used 29 players in six Test matches. When you think about this, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a six-Test series. But so the 11 picked in the first test, that leaves 18. So there's three changes a Test match. I mean, that's a quarter of your side being changed every test. But I suppose the highlights of it, well, not the highlight, the principal reason for that, well, one of the principal reasons was the South African Rebel Tour being announced. And for myself, that became apparent really in my second Test match, which would have been Old Trafford. And Old Trafford was ridiculous. So the Australians used to get the home dressing rooms because they had a big touring party in England. They had three dressing rooms. There was a captain's room, which the captain was in. There was a second level dressing room. There was another dressing room at the back of the pavilion. It was an overflow. So England was sort of sparsely spread around this floor, around the showers and everywhere at Old Trafford. And I was at the back dressing room. And in that back dressing room was where all the dealings were going on. Are you going to South Africa? Because John Embry was quite involved in that. And to sort of I mean, Neil Foster, I think, played in that, and he was in tears because he'd signed up and he knew that this was going to be his last. Well, he might have come back and played for England again, actually. I don't know. But to sort of, it's this biggest moment in your career, sort of to play for England and what it means to you, to suddenly see people saying, no, I've had enough of this, I'd rather go and earn some extra money playing on a Rebel tour in South Africa. It was sort of disillusioned you, really. I mean, sort of. It was a dreadful summer in the way that we lost against all expectations. The undercurrent of the Rebel Tour to South Africa and everything that went on. But I suppose having come through that, it was then a really enjoyable period. Graham Gooch took charge as captain. Mickey Stewart was a fantastic coach. I love Mickey Stewart, absolutely brilliant man. And a young England side suddenly.
Yeah,
moving forward, so out of this sort of dark period became a little period of hope, and we went to the West Indies that winter and performed well. I mean, everybody was expecting a blackwash, another blackwash as they were being called.
Yeah,
we won the first test in Jamaica. The second test match in Ghana was rained off, I think, and then the third test match in Trinidad we were on top, and some sort of slightly speculative sort of antics by Desmond Haynes, who was the West Indies captain in that game, time wasting prevented us winning the second test, so we're going 2-0 up, and then the West Indies came back and beat us narrowly at Barbados and then thumped us in Antigua. So to come out of that tour only losing 2-1 and having put in some pretty good performances was a really encouraging sign, actually.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
During his career, Angus shines in the Caribbean sun. Twice he takes 8 wickets in an innings away to the West Indies. The first comes at the Kensington Oval in Bridgetown, Barbados in the winter of 1994. 8 for 75 in the first innings, and Alex Stewart hits a century in both innings as England win that memorable test by 208 runs. We'll hear in a moment who wasn't impressed with his 8-wicket haul, but before that, was this Angus's favourite moment in an England shirt?
I think if I look back at my career, all right, we lost a series. I mean, the last test of that series was the one where Lara got 375, so it was a 3-1 defeat. But that's probably the greatest game of cricket that I had the good fortune of playing in, because it was Barmy Army starting to get going, lots of England supporters, Kensington Oval, Barbados is just a fantastic ground. All right, you compare the facilities to those that are now at a lot of stadia and they're pretty awful.
Yeah.
But talking about a ground with an atmosphere, with characteristic. And
it's West got Indies, history as well, hasn't it?
Huge, you know, history. And a small ground, sort of intense, sort of quite intimidating, and full houses as well. So maybe a ground that only holds 15,000 people, but there were probably 8,000 England supporters there and the locals. And it was a fantastic week where sort of cricket is celebrated. And that's why Right. You go to Australia, you travel business class, you're staying in wonderful hotels, the practice facilities are great. There's nothing you want for. In the evenings, you can go out, you can go to nice restaurants, you can drink fine wine or whatever you want to do. Everything away from the cricket is, but the cricket's hard. It's not much fun. I mean, when the media get hold of you and they're trying to belittle you and just make you feel small and totally inept, it's a hard place to play.
Yeah.
And South Africa was quite similar in some ways, although not quite the facility. But the West Indies was cricket almost as it should be played. It was raw. The facilities were raw. But the England coming to an island was their big sporting week of the year. And it was a celebration of cricket, even though the sort of the cricket they played was pretty ruthless at times. But that's why I suppose that combined with the fact that I did have success in the Caribbean is why I always look back at those tours with the greatest fondness.
Even though you take that 8 for 75, you're still criticised by the chairman of selectors, N. Railingworth. You know, he said at the time that, you know, you weren't fit enough to play Test cricket. It's a weird relationship that you have with Railingworth. He seemed to almost have it in for you. Did you feel victimised at all by him?
Victimised might be a strong word, but certainly, I suppose every people have their idea of... I think some of the Inningworth... I mean, Ian Atherton didn't particularly get on. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, no one can dispute that Railingworth had a great cricket brain and achieved a huge amount in his career and quite rightly was highly regarded. I think that his involvement with the England side came too late, to some extent. I think it sort of gone past him, really, as this guru-type figure. But he had his ideas. Others, Mike Atherton, was a good mate of mine, was as stubborn as they come, and obviously he's had a fantastic post-cricket career in the media. And others didn't pick me because I was his mate. He picked me because I thought I was a good bowler, but anyway, I think felt others was looking after me. And he sort of saw other bowlers, and therefore, whenever I didn't perform it, I was question marked and things like that. So, yeah, for him to question your fitness, I mean, all right, I don't never pretended to sort of walk around like some sort of cut Adonis. But I can question someone's fitness, and they're bowling 700 or 800 overs a year in county cricket and performing. So... yeah, it did get a bit personal at times in some of the things that he said, and maybe my reaction is not one to sort of just let it brush over. So I sort of said a couple of things as well, which maybe didn't help. But I think I got done. Well, David Norrie used to write for the News of the World, so so that was 93, 94, 94, 95. That would have been an Ashes tour, wasn't it? It was 94,
95 was the Ashes,
and I got left out of that tour, and I only found out on Sky. I was sort of watching Sky, and it was one of those moments where you're trying to do your alphabet and you think, right, they went to Gough, and you thought, where's F, and by the time they got to McCaig,
yeah.
I realised I wasn't going, and I was pretty cut up about that. Alright, one being left out, but two finding out in that manner. And David Norrie, who I knew quite well, sort of phoned me up and said, do you want to do can we do a piece for you in the News of the World? And they paid me for it, so I'm not sort of trying to pretend. He was quite good, because he said, I will pay you for it, just to sort of soften the blow of not being selected. And I was sort of talking about my finding out, and I said, it's easy to phone someone up after the event, but it takes I'm trying to think of my language.
It was guts.
Yeah,
because they use the headlines.
Yeah,
gutless.
Yeah,
Fraser calls
right.
England gutless,
that's right.
Or something
that's
like
right.
that.
So it takes a bit of guts to phone them up and break the news. It's easy to phone up after the event, but it takes a bit of guts to phone up and.
Yeah.
So the headline was ending with "You're gutless," and that probably didn't that didn't help our relationship after that, and that was quite early on. So.
Did you ever speak to him post your playing career, or was it? Did you just kind of leave it? Was there any kind of atonement or kind of conversation?
No, he was. I mean, he was always quite nice. I mean, I just wasn't his type of cricketer. The Atherton angle might have been slightly there, but he had obviously Gough coming through. There was Craig White. Martin McCaig, Joey Benjamin, there were sort of a number of bowlers. I don't know why, but perhaps because I didn't sort of worship the ground he trod on at times. But and you look, and it's, you sit back now and you're very proud of what you achieved in England cricket. It'd been nice to have done a little bit more. You think I could quite easily have, without my injury, with a bit more consistent selection, played another 25 tests and working at 4 tests a game, which is what I got, another 100 wickets. And if I'd have taken sort of high 200 test wickets at 27 apiece, I think that's as good as I probably was, or something as much as I was capable of achieving. Still, 180 tests, 177 test wickets is nothing to be ashamed of by any means, but you'd always sort of think it'd be nice to be a bit higher up that all-time England list, because I think I sneaked into the top 10 for a while. But then all of a sudden you sort of Caddick, Gough, Flintoff, Harmison, Hoggard, Swan, they've all gone past me, so I don't know where I am now. Once I went past 12, I thought, oh,
you're a bit further down. But I mean, I did actually do a little bit of research on those stats, and what I did find that since the Second World War, you're England's third leading wicket taker of any players who have played 50 tests or fewer. So if you go below that 50 test mark, you're basically third on the list post-war. So you've got John Snow, 49 tests, 202 wickets at 26. Jim Laker, 46 tests, 193 wickets at 21. And then yourself next, also 46 tests, 177. So, you know, if you look at it that way, if you take it, anyone that's played fewer than 50 tests, that selection, injuries or whatever, you're right up there.
I feel uncomfortable talking about yourself and sort of what you achieved. You almost think it's more for other people to talk about than yourself, but I'd say it's my fifers, so 13 fifers in 46 tests, so you're getting a five for every 3.5 test matches. That's better than most, so you're actually putting in potential match winning performances quite regularly, which is something. And your average, I think only Jimmy Anderson probably sneaked under me since I retired. I think how Tremlett might have got there, he might be around about that. But so there are a lot of things. There's enough there to say you could bowl a bit, but I say you don't want to go around telling people. It's for other people to talk about you rather than yourself.
Well, today we're definitely talking about it, Gus. Let's talk about one of those fifers. It is the Lord's Cricket Podcast. I want to talk about the one in 1995. You've twice got on the honours board here. Mm. Once against once against India in 1990. That was your first test, but that was kind of overshadowed by Graham Gooch scoring a treble 100.
That was and 100 in the second innings.
And 100 in the second innings. But let's talk about 95. That was England versus the West Indies. It was here at Lord's. What was it like as a Middlesex player and an England player coming to this great ground?
Well, again, you look back at that, and I dropped for the first test by Mr. Illingworth. So I left out of that. I don't know why, but when I was perceived to have been there'd been an injustice, either it was me rising to the occasion or good fortune sort of shining my way, I sort of came back and produce something. So I'd been left out the first test match. England lost that, but playing at Lord's is just special. I mean, so you just have to, although the dressing rooms are being redone, aren't they, so it's not going to be honours boards anymore, but honours walls or what it's going to be. But to sort of, you realise how big a thing it is for everybody, and I think that it's the same for yourself. It's not something you ever take for granted. And right, I arrived there having had my name on there once, but you just want to be up there as much as you can, because you can see the way that other people performed. And playing here is special in a way because of it's different. It's got a different feel to it. It's not as sort of raucous and parochial as some ground. It's a more sort of Lord's sort of murmur, isn't there? Sort of people conversing and sort of spending quality time with each other rather than let's get him over exuberant with the alcohol as the day goes on. But I mean, playing in that game, it was 95, Ashes series 94-95. I played in the last test at Perth, and I was on 99 test wicket, so I took my 100th test wicket here, and it happened to be Brian Lara actually, so it was a pretty good scalp.
That was the first of your five in that.
So LBW, I don't think it probably survived DRS. But it was a good appeal. It was just after lunch, so we caught him by surprise. I think Venkat was an umpire. But it's, yeah, so to get that, and I remember Gough took a good catch at Farnegg. I think it was Mike Keith Atherton who
that was the final wicket of your five. So you, Lara, LBW, Fraser for six, then Richie Richardson caught behind Stewart for 49, Jimmy Adams, LBW, Curtly Ambrose caught ramps, bowled Fraser, and then yeah, Keith Atherton, who was batting well actually, managed to give the West Indies I think a slender lead, and caught by Gough for 75. So that was your 5-wicket haul, and the Dazzler doing a bit of acrobatics down there in front of the.
Well, he sort of ran back and took the catch over his head, and sort of fell back and banged his head on the turf. But he almost had a look at the camera to make sure they'd noticed it before he got up, type of thing. Never, always aware where the cameras were, Goughy. I know, you look back, I have to say, again, looking back at other innings, I performed in the first innings of Test matches, and I always remember sort of Andy Caddick tended to perform more in second innings of Test matches, and I sat down with Caddick talking, and sort of, I said, yeah, he does too much in the first innings, they don't find the edge. So that was Caddick's reason why. In the second innings, it doesn't do as much, because the ball's not swinging around as much, so they edge it rather than miss it. So that's Caddick's modest. So, but the fact is, I got a lot of first innings fifers as well. So you're sort of, in many ways, playing a role in directing where the game is. And obviously, that performance was slightly overshadowed by Dominic Cook, who got 7 in the second innings, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
On his debut. But that was a fantastic game of cricket to win. I remember. No, I won't go into that story. I remember there was a streaker, but so I won't go into that one when I went out to bat. But the other thing was, and it showed the environment that you played in then. So England won the Test match. I think I had one beer in the dressing room before there was a coach waiting for me at the Grace Gate, because Middlesex had a NatWest game the following day down in Cornwall. And so pack your bags, get your kit in the back of the bus, all the blokes, where are you? It's come on, you know. So it's sort of like six hour drive coach journey down to Cornwall.
No rest for the wicked.
Got in the bedroom, bed wasn't big enough, so I just basically had to dismantle the bed, chuck the mattress on the floor, slept on the floor, turned up to the game. It was a red hot day, bowled three overs because it was one of those games where Middlesex were obviously going to win it quite early on, and the gaffer said, "We no point in you bowling anymore." So that was my another 6 hour coach journey back. And you think, what is that the way you look after?
Yeah,
you know, sort of someone that sort of 24 hours earlier was winning a Test match in front of 30,000 people. Well, in a fantastic sort of winning a fantastic Test match against the West Indies in front of 25,000-30,000 people here.
It was a great Test. It was a great series
as
well.
What did we win by, actually?
They won by 72 runs. Mm. So yeah, ended up, you know, pitch invasion, sort of old fashioned pitch invasion.
I miss them. I know the reasons why they're not done, because of player safety and spectator safety, and they were fantastic sights. That you really felt close to things, but you can understand why it doesn't take place now. But it's taken a little bit away, I think, again, for spectators to get on the outfield at the end of the game and to sort of get a closer inspection of what's taking place in the middle. Makes them feel much more part of what's happened.
Absolutely. And there's always that, there's a kind of excitement, because as the players you kind of have to leg it off the pitch, and the fans are trying to sort of grab you, so there's this, I don't know, I've watched quite a few back, and when I was a teenager, I went to. I was part of some of those, so yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, players are scrambling for stumps, so yeah. Souvenir. I mean, I suppose nowadays, a spectator nicks one of those stump cameras, they're worth a few thousand quid. They are, but so there's stumps, bales, caps as well. You've got to take your cap off because that's a good souvenir for someone. So you become very aware that someone's going to could try and thieve something off you as you're running off the field. Which is probably not ideal, but equally there is an exhilaration to that you probably don't quite get now.
in 1998, one of Angus's good friends resigns the England captaincy. Until Alistair Cook in recent years, Mike Atherton was England's longest-serving captain with 54 games in charge. But in Antigua, at the end of a fraught series in the West Indies, Athers calls it a day. Naturally, an emotional moment for Angus and his teammates. Well, except Phil Tufnell.
It ended on a disappointing and sort of collapse, didn't we? Lost 7 or 8 wickets in the last session, having to lose a game that we should have drawn. And Tufnell was the last man out, and I think he got gloved one off Walsh to short leg or something like that. Wasn't particularly in line with the ball. And all Tufnell was worried about was, did he look scared or was he backing away and these sort of things. And so we sat there and in sort of quite a sort of rectangular dressing room, and Athers is in the middle, and I'm sort of sat here. And I think Mark Rambrakesh was to my left, and Tufnell was obviously the last man. He was sort of almost slightly behind Athers, so Athers couldn't see him, and Athers was sort of speaking to the team about the fact that he was, thanks for his support, but I'm standing down. And all Tufnell was gesticulating to Rambrakesh about was sort of almost like, was I backing away? Was I backing away? And it's like the moment's completely lost in him, that the fact that sort of a modern great of English cricket, Mike Atherton, is standing down as captain. All Tufnell is worried about is, did it look back on, did his dismissal look bad on TV, type of thing. And there was quite a few tears shed, actually. It was really sad, because he might not agree with everything others did, and that every time, and at times he probably, and other people, he's a stubborn pig-headed bugger. But love him dearly, and no one could ever sort of say that he didn't have the best interests of English cricket. Paid for a lot of discomfort with his back, as tough as so-and-so, and as you're going to come across. So, yeah, it was a really, really sort of end of an era, really, wasn't it?
You mentioned the tears there. You are sometimes perceived as, quite a tough, at times grumpy person, but you've also shed a few tears throughout your career. Are you emotional in terms of?
Yeah. I am, because you care about what you do. You care about Middlesex. You care about England. You care about the people that are there, and you want to see them do well. You don't want to see them suffer and have a miserable time. And you take, when things don't go well, you take it personally, and you feel responsible for it. And so, yeah, you quite. I mean, It's interesting the number of times people sort of say, you sort of shared a dressing room, the number of times you come in with your head in the towel. And dressing rooms are emotional places, and it's, you're desperate to do well, you want to do well, you try so hard, you commit a lot, not just physically, I mean, alright, you're getting paid during your career, so I'm not looking for any sympathy or anything like that, but you commit a huge amount to what you're trying to do, and when it's not going right, it hurts, and you despair. It really do despair, especially when you feel that you're bowling well, you're doing things and nothing's going your way, and when's my next wicket coming from, and you don't begrudge other teammates, but you see other people, Christ, look at him, he's got 2 bloody wickets, spawny wickets. LBW is never out, and all you're doing is playing and missing, you've had decisions turned down, catches dropped, edges through third man, and it's like, oh my god, and you sit there with your towel over your head having a quiet little moment to yourself, type of thing. So as a player you did that, and again, winning is hugely satisfying, and you want to repeat that as often as you can. And the same with Middlesex. I mean, we've had four sort of completely contrasting years. So you finish second one year, you win the championship the next, which is a special moment. We get relegated, and we've underperformed last year as a club, and it's not, you don't enjoy it. I don't enjoy it, and you don't want to be sitting there going through the motions, sort of waiting at that, say playing a game at Lord's, so you wait at the visitors' dressing room and shake their hands and say well done. You want them saying well done to you.
Indeed. The when you became a journalist, I was reading that sort of ended effectively your Middlesex career there and then, and again, that was, I was quite surprised by this. It was tough for you. You know, I think you sat in a car and you broke into tears because it was, that was tough.
It was because, no, nothing else. Been hugely fortunate to have a sort of 18, 19 year career. And that winter, you realise England's gone. So that sort of ended in 99, really. And England started on a new journey, which, with Duncan Fletcher and Nasser Hussain, which is perfectly entitled. Well, maybe I could have played 99, but...
Did you know your England career was over then?
No, because you never give it up, do you? You always think you're going to be good enough. You always think you can still do a job. And I think in 99, in that New Zealand series, I probably could have done the job. I mean, again, my England career came to an end. That's an interesting one. I was Middlesex were playing... my last contact with England. Middlesex were playing Somerset down in Taunton. And so the test matches here at Lord's. And I got a phone call from David Graveney on the Wednesday night. So the game starts on the Thursday, on the Wednesday night, saying, Gus, could you get back to Lord's? One of the players is ill, I can't remember who it was, and would like you to be there as cover, because the nature of the pitch means that you may well play the next day. So could you get back? And I couldn't get back. Two reasons. He phoned me up sort of 7:30 at night. One, I had a couple of pints, so I couldn't drive. And two, my kit was locked in the dressing room at Taunton, and so I couldn't get in there. The ground was locked up at the end of a day's play. So I got up at the crack of dawn the next morning, went to the ground, got my kit out, put it in the car, drove back to Lourdes on the sort of M5, M4. I got the Hogarth roundabout, and mobile phone rung, and it was David Graveney saying, it's all right, Gus, he's fit, he's woken up feeling a lot better, you can turn around. So it was almost just as I got the Hogarth roundabout where the Fuller's Brewery is on the A4.
Yeah.
And just went straight around the roundabout and went all the way back to Taunton to carry on playing for Middlesex that morning. I got one for 100. Triscothic got 100 against us, played well. It was one of the first times I gave him a bit of a volley and obviously inspired him that day. And that was the last contact I had with England in 1999, and you never feel it's going to go, but and I suppose to many extent the sort of Middlesex captaincy that came along for a year or so after that was you want to get your teeth stuck into something, and we'd having a few difficult years. Do you stay? Do you go? Do you find some fresh motivation? No, you stay and you help out, and sort of doing the captaincy was one thing, and hopefully sort of starting a little bit of a period where, although I mean I retired. The winter 2001-2, I'd spent with the media, sort of commentating with Test Match Special, yeah. Writing for The Guardian, as it was then. I used to write my own stuff rather than have it ghostwritten, which Shieldberry sort of advised me to do when I had a sort of column in the Sunday Telegraph. So word had got around that you wrote your own pieces as well as sort of had your own views, which didn't hold, but not that you were sort of deliberately contentious, but you obviously was of enough interest, and got back from being away with Test Match Special for Middlesex pre-season. So I got a phone call out of the blue from the Independent sports editor, Paul Newman. Could I meet you for a bit of lunch? Yes, we met. Then could Simon Kellner and I meet you? And they offered me the job for a bit of lunch and came back here, as you say. And what am I going to do? I'm 35, 36. I love cricket. I've been in cricket. Means I've cut my career maybe a year or so shorter with Middlesex than it could be, but it gives me an opportunity to do something and still be involved in the sport. And it was a simple decision, but the fact that... And I spoke to a couple of people, Alan Moss at Middlesex, who's a really good man, and Don Bennett, who was no longer a coach, and they both said, look, you've got to look after yourself and go. So that made it easier. Not easier, but sort of confirmed to me that the decision I was making was the right one. But to say goodbye to a playing career is... It's hard. It's hard because, as I said at the start, you miss the competing, you miss the... It was easy to judge what a good day, what a successful day in your life looked like, even by wickets, by runs, by some contribution you made to the team. But writing an 800-word piece, I didn't know whether that was good or not. I didn't know whether my commentary had been good or not. You just sit there and did it. But, but it was the right thing to do.
It's clear.
And he never gives me credit for it, but I mean, as a captain, I named Strauss as my vice captain, and it sort of
launched. Passing of the guards.
Yeah, it launched Strauss into. I'd love to say it was my sort of generosity in retiring to allow Strauss to sort of sort of follow his natural course, which was the reason. It wasn't, it was I had an opportunity, and Strauss became Middlesex captain, and the rest is history for him, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Sitting here now, just to finish on it, it's clear that, I mean, you had a fantastic career, you're very proud of it. You sort of alluded to the fact that you do miss it. What do you sort of take away from your career now, at the age of, the grand old age of 53, as you said earlier?
How lucky I was to sort of be a 12-year-old boy playing in the streets in Harrow Weald with my brother and three or four other boys of a similar age, and to, through cricket, well, to have had the chance to play here and travel the world and have the life that you've had involved in this sport. And I think how fortunate, I don't appreciate that as much as I should do. Again, Middlesex had a couple of difficult years, and you start feeling sorry for yourself, and how much longer do you want to keep putting yourself through it? But yeah, it's I don't know what other sports are like, but there's not many nasty people in cricket. There's a lot of good people who care passionately about the game, want the right thing for the game. Yes, they have different views, and but it's a good sport, and it's a fantastic game. And I think privileged to have played it for the last, or have been involved professionally in it for 35 years, and to still be, or to be sat here now with you, chatting about this, but with my office where I work just being probably 30 yards away as the crow flies. And to drive through the Grace Gates and park my car in number 6, to walk through the long room when you want. It's, nice.
And just to finish on, we don't know what the future holds, but 2016 was obviously an extremely special year for you as managing director of cricket, to watch Middlesex win the first county title they'd won since 1993. In recent years, that must be your proudest moment.
I do, and I think I look back on that with greater satisfaction than my personal achievements as a player. I think as a player, yes, you get a huge amount of joy from playing in a team and enjoying that those moments as a team, but it's quite a selfish existence. Certainly during the 90s, maybe with the selection policies that were in place, you had to look after yourself, and it was probably one of the reasons why the England side that I played for underachieved, really. I mean, everybody thought there were one or two test matches from being dropped, because there seemed to be a bit of a randomness about selection then, and it bred a slightly selfish individual that looked after himself. And whilst you sort of walked a game sometimes having achieved something, it wasn't sort of, the icing on the cake wasn't there, which was a win. But so yeah, the afternoon at Lord's back in September 2016 means more to me probably than anything I achieved as a player, just to try and to get a group of people together, or to play a role in getting a group of people together to achieve something like that, and in such a sensational manner. I mean, a lot of people here at Lord's, wonderful scenes at the end. It couldn't have been better. When Middlesex do things, they don't do it for half measures, that's for sure. They tend to do it in quite dramatic style, whether it's going up, going down, or anything.
Here's Roland Jones from the pavilion end, 178 for 9. We're in the 36th over of this Yorkshire innings, 4.5 overs to go. Roland Jones, his right arm over the wicket, bowling to Ryan Sidebottom, and he's bowled in, leg stumps out of the ground. That's it, Middlesex have won the title, the 23-year wait is over. Sidebottom goes first ball, Roland Jones has 2 in 2, and Middlesex have finally claimed the crown once more. Middlesex win the pennant. And Yorkshire, the defending champions, their hat-trick chase over. Roland Jones disappears down below the Warner stands in a heap underneath the Compton. Wow, absolutely amazing from Middlesex, amazing scenes. 4.4 overs remaining of the season. Brooks at the other end, they can't believe it, Yorkshire. 178 all out. But Middlesex have won the county championship once again for the first time in 23 years.
The joy that sort of gave a lot of people. I met the bloke, actually. There's a famous sort of image of a man in the top. I mean, the pavilion was packed, and a sort of man on the top tier, sort of in tears when Middlesex won it, and met him this summer, actually, and gave him one of the prints that we had done by Jack Russell to sort of commemorate the achievement, and to sort of see that it meant that much to a lot of people is really satisfying. And need to do it again now. It never ends. You sort of, I suppose, it's the thing about, I don't think sports are any different to other people, but people don't say, oh, sports are far more kind of, but you sort of achieve one thing, right, we've done that, we've got to do it again now. And the sort of the desire to succeed doesn't wane,
still got it. Well, thank you very much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure going down memory lane and finishing on the more modern era. So thank you very much.
No trouble at all.
You've been listening to the Lords Cricket Podcast, the stories from the home of cricket with the people that made them. That was the Angus Fraser story and that 5 for 66 against the West Indies. It was great sitting down with Gus there. Many people sort of know him as Grumpy Gus. I think Gus is actually a hilarious character, really, and has a really good sense of humour. He plays that kind of downbeat sort of character well, but he's also... There's a real soft side to him. You know, he used to run in and bowl and give people an absolute volley and, you know, kick the dust away. You know, he's one of those bowlers that it almost, you know, he'll openly admit it, you know, not conceding runs for him was almost as important as taking wickets. But there is that soft side to him. There's that emotional side to him. And he talked about that. And actually, towards the end of the podcast, he was quite emotional. There was almost a tear in his eye as I sat down with him in the members' lounge here at Lord's. And he looked back at his career and with an immense sense of pride, I think, and also humility. I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did. A big thanks to Angus for taking his time to record the podcast. Thanks again for listening. Please do get in touch with the show via Twitter at Homer Cricket, or me personally. I'm on at Will Row 2. That's my Twitter handle. Any feedbacks, welcome. Nice stuff, preferably. Thank you. You can also email the show, podcast@mcc.org.uk. And also, please give us a rating and a review on iTunes or whatever you listen to your podcasts, and subscribe. Make sure you subscribe. Next week's guest is Bob Willis. These days, Bob plays the part of an almost pantomime villain in his assessment of England on Sky's Cricket, the debate programme. But he was once England's premier fast bowler, 325 wickets in 90 tests. Bob is probably most famous for that 8-for-43 to win the 1981 Headingley Test and the Ashes. But he also performed brilliantly at Lord's. We discuss all that and his childhood memories of being a grumpy teenager, growing up in suburban Surrey, playing in Australia, captain in England, and getting in the zone here at Lord's, and so much more. It's a great sit down there with Bob. So that's next week's Lord's Cricket Podcast with Bob Willis.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.